Welcome to the R4R podcast. I'm Karen Conley, the Executive Director of Race for Reconciliation, and I am so thrilled to have you joining us today. This is part two of a series that we are doing as we launch Race for Reconciliation. I want to invite back and welcome my dear friend and amazing guest, Vanetta West. Vanetta, thank you for doing a part two with me right now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, if you missed our first video or our first podcast, depending on what format you are following us on, I really want to encourage you to go check out our part one of the series. We're really talking about the five majors, the five pillars, the five foundations of who we want to be as an organization, as a movement. We have a heart to educate and elevate. That's what we want this podcast to do. We want to create conversations that educate about this topic of racial reconciliation and elevate. It's not enough to learn. We must bring change. We have got to be able, as Americans in this context, to be able to decide that enough is enough, and how can we really bring change to solve some of the systemic problems that are with us even today across our country. And Vanetta comes as a person who has walked in this space. And Vanetta, I read your bio in our last podcast, and I didn't even get to the fact that you have your doctorate of ministry, you have created a school in Liberia, you worked in nonprofit for 20 years, and obviously you have been a trainer and curriculum developer for the King Center, a social media strategist, a writer. You are an amazing woman. But what I love most about you is your heart. And I just really appreciate the way that you've been willing to walk with us as we launch this platform so that we can provide a way to go into cities across America with, yes, races. We will do literal 1 mile fun runs and 5Ks and 10Ks. And that really is, we wanted to become a positive, unifying voice on the subject of racial reconciliation. And these five majors that we're talking about really are to help us keep focused on what matters. And so we talked in our first one, Vanetta, and I appreciate you and what you had to say on redefining reconciliation, knowing that for so long we have just thought, let's all shake hands and be friends, and realizing that that is not enough. That we have to address the systems and the structures that have existed for generations now that still cause oppression and injustice to happen in our culture. The second focus that we have, this second major, is what we're calling tackling tokenism. And I know in our first podcast, you talked about struggle words. Words that cause Vanetta and many others to struggle. I think the first one, the first struggle word, I've created this list, struggle words, okay? The first one is privilege. I think you might have alluded to as we were coming on that tokenism would be another struggle word. That word, tell us in your perspective, explain that, why that is on your struggle word list. I think I know, but I want to hear from you.
Tokenism for me is, you know, the notion that we have one Black something or one Latino somebody or one, you know, woman somebody, you know, one gay somebody. And so because we have this token, we're exempt from being racist. We're exempt from being sexist. So I have one person who's my token who allows me to say, you can't call me that, because I have this. I have a Black friend. I have a Black employee. You know, I have a Black person in my life. And then they become a token. You hear it when people, they go into these places where they're in danger and, you know, they've said something or done something and people are labeling them or saying they're racist or, you know, there's some type of ism. And they start to say, well, I have a, and you're just like, oh no, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't say it.
Yeah. Well, Vanetta, go ahead.
Having a token doesn't mean you're not racist. Right. Racism, as we talked about in the previous podcast, is systemic. It's a power construct. And I can have, as a white person, I can have black friends, a black friend, and still be complicit in racism.
Well, let me do this as we continue this conversation. I want to bring to our audience really kind of this major in its full context, because some of what you just referred to, we actually have worded in this. And I think it's honestly a conversation that, just as a white person, I'm going to say every white person needs to hear. So let me read this to you. It'll be on the screen if you're watching via video. But our second major is tackling tokenism. We believe that the assertion and belief that I'm not racist because I, quote, have a black friend is harmful and hinders reconciliation. Authentic friendship wants the best for each other, and systemic and structural racism is far from the best for black people in America. How can I be a friend if the burden of racism is not something I'm working to lift? And so in that major, as we talk about that, honestly, it just hits me square between the eyes, because I was, if you went back 7 or 8 years ago, I probably would have answered the question, are you racist, with no. I mean, yeah, I grew up in a mainly white school, but I had a few black friends. I even had a crush on a black guy. And so surely I'm not racist. Mm-hmm. Help a white person understand why that's not enough.
Sure. And that's, Karen, that's beyond, you know, even white and black people. If somebody asks me, am I anti-Semitic? If I start to say, no, I have Jewish friends, mm-hmm. then for me too, then I'm practicing this kind of tokenism. It's just not enough. Mm-hmm. First, I think a struggle word that a lot of us don't really realize is a struggle word for us is friendship. The older I've gotten, the more I've redefined, I'm telling you. Mm-hmm. I look at people and I say, I don't think we're friends. Because my definition has changed as I matured. Certainly as I started to hit 40, I said, I think I only have like 5 friends, because it shifted. And so it's not enough, because if you're authentically my friend, then how can you not care about not only my condition and how racism impacts me, but also the condition of my family, the condition of my people, my lineage, my ancestors, what happened to them? How can you not be concerned about that? And so friendship has to be, for a lot of us, redefined. Mm-hmm. So it's not enough to say, hey, I know Vanetta. I'm friends with Vanetta. But if you really know me, then you know these issues are something that I think about every day. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned, like really internally in my mind, my heart, about how we as humanity are going to shift and change. Now, if you're my friend and you know those are concerns for me and things concerning me, then you move beyond this kind of thing of Vanetta's my black friend. Mm-hmm. And I certainly hope that's not how anybody would describe me anyway. If so, I need to know so I can say we're not friends.
But taking off that list.
Scratch. But definitely, I hope, you know, when you're developing relationships, you start to be concerned about what that person's concerned about. Mm-hmm. Israel Houghton had this song years ago he released, and he said, God, give us a heart for things that break your heart. Mm-hmm. And I started to pray that on a regular basis once I heard that song. Just for me, give me a heart for things that break your heart. And so even in my relationships, if something is breaking my friend's heart, I start to say, God, give me a heart for that, because that's really hurting them. What is it? And that's how people say, how do you develop compassion? That's it. Yes. You know, what's heartbreaking for this person, just genuinely mm-hmm. causing them pain? Let me be attentive to that and understand it. That moves beyond tokenism. It's essential that we get out of that space.
Vanetta, I love what you just said. I also love, even between recordings, we were having a conversation and really, you know, we started talking about, you know, the difference between the similarities, I should say, between sexism and classism and all the different isms that are out there, and really said, okay, what's the root of all of these? Power, somebody feeling elevated over someone else, and really it goes down to the heart level. Talk a little bit about the heart in this, because I think sometimes it feels, this conversation can feel so overwhelming. How can any of us individually change generations worth of pain? But if we look at it at the heart level, elaborate on that, because to me that gives hope at the individual level. Yes, there's responsibility, but there's something you can do. Would you talk about the heart level?
Absolutely. You know, the heart is, when I was developing a sermon like 15, 20 years ago on the heart, I looked up the word, and it's rooted in a word called charis, which means the center of your will or emotions. So when I think about the heart, for me personally, I think, you know, the heart is the center of my will. It's the center of my emotions. It's the center of what I determine is right and fair and just. You think about that in terms of racism and in terms of any ism, if the heart is hard and the heart is evil and the heart is not bent towards justice and it's the center of our will, then of course we won't have any push or any real persistence in eradicating racism, because the center of my will is not bent towards eradicating racism. And whatever I have the will to do, I do it. If you think about the heart that way, then it kind of, it shifts us from thinking, oh, the heart is just mushy, it's this emotional place where, you know, it's where we cry, we weep, we're just compassionate. No, it's what determines what I care about and what I'm willing to work toward. And so Dr. King believed we can have heart change and legislative change, that we don't have to choose one or the other. However, he said this, even if your heart doesn't change, we need legislative change, because you know what? A law might not stop somebody from hating me, but it can stop them from lynching me. Mm. And so we need to change laws, but if hearts don't change, then we never really fully get to a place where we can have reconciliation. You just have, well, you can vote now, you should be okay, shut up, you know. And you can sit on the bus with us now, you should be okay, be quiet. But that's not reconciliation, and that's not true justice, and that's not heart change. Mm-hmm. So personally, I can determine if there's bigotry in me, if there's bigotry I've learned, if there's any prejudice that I've learned over the course of my life, that I want to change my heart. And that's difficult even to get to that first step, but it starts with this. If people listening could just say, hey, I realize I've learned some things that are not right. I've learned some things that I've accepted as truth that I need to change. Everybody can say that. You don't have to list what it is. You know, you can just start right there. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you're a person of faith, you can say, I want to be better. And I'm going to start praying that my heart changes and that the center of my will shifts so that it's bent towards love, justice, and fairness, mercy, peace, all those great things that we believe, I think you believe as well, come with the kingdom of God. And we can start to say, hey, I want my heart to be bent towards these things. You start there. You don't have to start listing, man, my grandfather was racist. Or man, I have photos of my family members lynching people. Those are hard. I look at those photos of people being lynched, and I look at the white people at the front grinning and laughing and stuff, and I wonder, who are their descendants?
Yeah.
And when they look at those photos, what do you do with that? Well, it's either I have a guilt complex and I don't really want to deal with it. I'm just going to deny it. I'm going to be angry about it. Or I'm going to say, I'm going to be that way too. And I'm going to be a person who today would be complicit in modern day lynchings, who today would say they're okay. It's okay for Black people to be violated. So the heart, it's really important that we shift that.
Well, and I think for anyone new to this conversation, that has to be the starting point. And
it does.
And that, you know, for me, as you just talked about that, I know I referred in our last podcast to the event that we hosted, and we went to the site where there was a lynching of a gentleman in Memphis. And to be honest with you, that moved my heart. That it, what you just said, how could anybody do this? Ever. And it is that asking, okay, let my heart be open and let me learn. And as we are allowing our hearts to be changed, then to me, this feels like a topic that anybody can walk in. I care about people, and it is not okay for this to continue to happen. And that to me makes it a positive, unifying message. Not that there aren't hard conversations, because it's hard. It's a lot easier to just pretend like you don't know and keep on if you're somebody, as you said last time, you face your race every day. I can talk about it, but I still get up and walk away. And in most cultures, I'm still in the majority. That's not the case for somebody who's Black. That I think Brian Laritz, just the other day was reading a tweet from his. He says, every time I stand up from the table, I still stand up a Black man. And that's something for somebody who we have the privilege, as you said, of deciding when we want to care and not. But if we ask for our hearts to be opened in this topic, I think that tackling tokenism really challenges all of us to say, okay, how much of a friend am I really if I don't really understand what's going on in my friends' lives that are different than me? If we've never really talked about how their race impacts their daily life, then maybe we are acquaintances, and maybe it's time for us to become friends. So I hope that that will be encouraging. And we still have to make a decision to do something. We have to still make a decision to make that advance to that friend, to have that awkward conversation, to get into wade into something that's messy and might make you feel bad as a white person to hear. Like, it doesn't feel good to hear that, but what progress can be made if our hearts are willing. Vanetta, in that definition, kind of our major, we talked about we have to deal with this because we want to also deal with systemic and structural racism. I know that you probably could teach for hours on that topic. It's like a huge, topic.
It is.
But can you, just from an education standpoint, if you are talking to somebody that is new in this space, kind of from the 50,000 foot level, describe what is systemic and structural racism?
Sure. Well, even people go back to, slaves were freed. And then I tell them the language I started to use and shift to enslaved people, so that I don't put the ownership for slavery on the people who were enslaved. But you have emancipation. But emancipation moved into still structural and systemic racism. Mm-hmm. You have a government that put Black people in ghettos. And if you think about the concentration camps in the Holocaust, they were called ghettos. Ghettos aren't places that you go to prosper. Mm-hmm. So there was even then the intent that Black people go to a place housed, packed into small communities where they didn't prosper, where there would still be poverty, where they would be fenced into a place separated from white people. So it's a form also of segregation. Mm-hmm. That's systemic, that's cultural, that's structured racism. Because then you're saying you're free, but not really. And then we're gonna have Jim Crow laws mm-hmm. That also impede you, where you're free, but not for real. Where you're still segregated. You can't have the best of. Mm-hmm. If you think about people saying today, Black people should be over that, when those Jim Crow laws, surely, just because some of those laws changed, you can't be telling me you really believe that some of those precepts, those concepts, that construct doesn't still exist mm-hmm. within systems here in the United States. Mm-hmm. You look now at redlining, voter suppression, the different things that can happen with gerrymandering that affects the Black vote, that affects the Latino vote. the different things that happen now with plants that go into certain communities that emit carcinogens. Look at Flint. It's a prime example of what can happen to a Black community in the United States, still not having clean water. Mm-hmm. That's structural systemic racism. Anything in a system that makes it clear that Black lives are less important or might not even matter at all. Mm-hmm. So you have this slogan, Black Lives Matter, and people say, well, all lives matter. Well, sure they do. Mm-hmm. It's clear in systems that white lives matter. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter is saying we have to really assert and chant and work for getting systemic change so that in our systems we can see, in our policing we can see, in our criminal justice system we can see, in our housing we can see that Black lives matter. And we don't see that yet. Mm-hmm. Because you still have laws that either they're stated or they're unstated, mm-hmm. that Black lives don't matter. Mm-hmm. It's not even for me that they don't matter as much. For some people, it's clear today from what I'm reading and hearing from them that Black lives just don't matter to them. Mm-hmm. It's some excuse that they can give as to why a Black life didn't matter.
Right. You know, we are going to talk about this in our pillar on walking in wisdom. But, you know, one of the things that is, I think, absolutely critical is for people to be willing to actually educate themselves. Because, you know, I remember walking through the Museum of African American History in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. And as I'm walking through there as a person of faith and thinking actually through the sequence of historical events that freedom was granted, you know, slaves were freed, emancipation happens. Okay, but in a very literal sense, as those people are freed, to your point, they're not really freed. And from a church perspective, I think what was stunning to me was, wait a minute, we have worked so hard in our ministry to bring a church that reflected the community that we were a part of. How did we ever get here? And if you go back and you realize, wow, when freedom was granted and they showed up at the churches and they were told, no, not here. There is a yes. problem. And so mm-hmm. For me, when I start to go back, as you just described that, okay, wait a minute. So freedom was granted, but you're
really.
When you're put in a place where you are not going to succeed, where you don't have healthcare, where you don't have what you need to feed your family, where you don't have the education, all of a sudden it paints a very different picture of why. We can see in families how generations pass things on for good or for bad, if you know, for prosperity or in poverty. Mm. So that education piece, I think, is really an important part of this, is just being willing to go back and think through it from a perspective that maybe you haven't before. Vanetta, we have talked about wanting to provide healing, honor, and hope, wanting to find a place that the silent middle is kind of what the term that I have used of people that, you know, here in the 21st century, maybe their heart is softening, but maybe they've not actually ever moved beyond, yeah, that's that. I feel bad about that. To actually becoming a person that helps bring change. What recommendation or advice would you give a white person who wants to move beyond hearing to truly walk along someone in a way that does bring honor?
You know, well, I've been thinking about for the last few minutes the state of emergency. You know, I think even as we were talking about heart change, I started to consider sometimes people's hearts change while they're in the midst of the work. Mm-hmm. And I think what brings healing, honor, and hope, specifically honor at this point, is to start to honor Black lives by saying, this is a state of emergency. This is urgent. You know, lives depend on it. That's for me, how my true authentic friends are honoring me right now. We can't wait. My friend that I felt comfortable talking to last week and saying, man, I am just really devastated by this. Mm-hmm. She honored me and she honored Black people by stepping up on a platform and saying, hey, look, you know, I have all of these white people that follow me. We have to do something. This is urgent. Mm-hmm. Black people are dying. Mm-hmm. Black people are being discriminated against in ways that affect their health, in ways that affect their mental health, in ways that affect them with their families, you know, their lives. So she started to say that. That to me was honor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Putting in work to me is honor. At this point, it's one of the main ways, the fundamental way to me to demonstrate. Because what else do we have now? Excuse me. Because we have talk. But what I know with these conversations is they'll lead to us saying, what do we do next? Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, they've been used to talking about these things. And then they don't say, how do we change systems? Mm-hmm. You know, they don't say, how do we really change some of these things that are constructs that affect and devastate Black families and Black people, you know, and Latino people and Asian people. I mean, you look across the board, unless you're white in this country, mm-hmm. you're facing some type of racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. And even when, as we were talking about on the break, even within that, there's classism and there's some type of structure, power construct that has people, white, male, Christian people, heterosexual people sitting at the top. Mm-hmm. And we're all dealing with it in some way. So honor to me is putting in work right now. You talk across the line when you talk to people, most Black people that I talk to, and you ask them, you know, how can you honor the struggle? How can you honor Black people? How can you demonstrate an honor, a sense of honor for the past and what we've been through and what we struggled through, and an honor for what we're trying to build for the future? It's not by anymore just being someone who says I'm with you, but actually showing that you're an ally and an advocate and you're working in these areas. That work, I think that could be like a tagline. Work is honor.
Yeah, that's great.
Putting it in.
Yeah. Well, Vanetta, I think this is a great place for us to wrap up this specific conversation. And I hope that—
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Did you have something
else? I think, you know, as I reflect back on this conversation, I think what I'm hearing from you and what I want to encourage our listeners is, even in the simplicity of, are you really a friend to somebody? And as we talk about the heart level, to say, as we build friendships with people that are different from ourselves, do we really build a friendship enough that we care about what they care about? And that we have those hard conversations. And if we can begin to do that at an individual level, then we will begin to do that as, you know, in our circle of influence, then we begin to do that in our cities. But it does start at the heart level. And so I appreciate the conversation. I look forward. There's so much more that we want to address and that we will get to in future podcasts and future videos. But thank you for lending your expertise, your wisdom, and your heart to this conversation. If you want more information, please go to raceforreconciliation.org. We've got resources there. Also find out about upcoming events there. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time.